worked. Ember and Umber decided who came, and that was that.
"You were the first one in. You started it all. You found the way. We both know you'll go again. It's only a question of when. You're the High King."
"I'm the High King," he repeated unhappily. At the time, I believed it, mostly. I was 10 and he was 12, but the gap between us had always seemed wider. I looked up to Martin. I literally couldn't imagine myself having something he did not, doing something he could not. But by the next summer, it was clear that something had changed between Martin and Fillory. The romance was over. In all that school year, he'd only gone over once. And then the Rams let him stay only 2 mingy, grudging, uneventful days. He spent those days sulking, ruining them out of spite, even though he knew they would likely be his last. He barely left the palace library. The Rams shunned his company. He was on the way out, and we all knew it. It wouldn't have been so bad except that out of all of us it was Martin who needed Fillory the most. Honestly, by that time I think Fiona could have taken or left it. She was already growing out of Fillory. For Jane, who was 5 when it began, it was just normal. She couldn't imagine life without it. It was barely even special. If the Rams had turned Helen out, she would have accepted it, no questions asked. Thy will be done. She would have taken a perverse pleasure in her martyrdom. As for me, I never believed it would last anyway. Every day, every second, I expected it to end. On some level, I would have been relieved. Maybe it was just that Martin was older, that he had lived longer without Fillory. He remembered what life was like without it, and he understood better than the rest of us did how strange and precious it was. The rest of us made friends outside the family, in the real world, but increasingly Martin did not. He shirked his lessons and filled his exercise books with winged bears they'd been seen circling over the hen's teeth, and Fillorian coats of arms. A natural athlete who barely had to try at games, he stopped trying at all. He scorned everything in this world, heaped contempt on it. He even ate less and less, as if a bite of shepherd's pie would trap him down here in the darkness like Persephone. He lived for Fillory. But Fillory didn't live for him. In my later life I have known alcoholics, more than a few, and I recognized in their faces some of what I saw in Martin's. Loyal prophets of an indifferent god. Martin might have fallen out of favor with Fillory, but never with Plover. Whatever happened at Whitespire, at Dara's house, he was always the favorite. If anything, Plover's affection for him seemed to grow in inverse proportion to that of the Rams, or maybe it was the other way round. Whatever the reason, Martin was the only one of us whom Mr. Plover ever invited to visit him alone. What they discussed in their private lunches and teas, Martin never told me, but as far as I can tell, those occasions didn't give him any special pleasure. He often returned from them in a brown study, and sometimes he made excuses to avoid them altogether. Now, of course, as a grown man with some knowledge of the world, I cannot help but wonder whether Plover's interest in my brother was entirely appropriate. Such speculation is inevitable, but as both parties are dead, or as good as, I suppose we should be charitable and assume that Plover merely took a fatherly interest in this bright, sensitive, fatherless boy. A mentor's interest. And yet, Martin and I only ever spoke about it once, and the memory is not a pleasant one. I asked him what they talked about, the two of them, on his visits, and he snapped at me. "If Plover ever asks you to come by yourself, don't go. Never go to that house alone." He made me promise, and I did, though Plover never did ask. At the time, I thought it was his pride. I thought he was jealously protecting his status as the favorite. But now I think it is possible that he was trying to warn me. Even protect me. I wish I knew. I haven't seen my brother in 25 years, but I sometimes think, when I am brooding on the past,
that that must have been part of Martin's need for fillery, his addiction to it. He went there to escape from our saintly benefactor, Christopher Plover, and to find better, wiser, or at least safer, mentors in the form of the Rams. And if that is the case, I cannot help but wonder, too, if, in a terrible irony, that was precisely why the Rams stopped bringing Martin to Fillory. Martin was fleeing from Plover, but Fillory didn't want him any more, because Plover had sullied him. At the time, these worries and doubts didn't trouble me, or not much, not enough. In the years since then, the shadows have grown deep and long, but at the time, the sun of Fillory was at its zenith, and I was a child, and any shadows were barely visible. That summer, the topic of Martin's mysterious exile was much whispered about in the relative privacy of our large, crumbling bedrooms at Dockery, especially when he wasn't there. What was the cause, and what could be done about it? We'd all tried to raise the matter with the Rams, but with no success. "This is not his time," they would say. "When he comes, he will come," and so forth. There was a great deal of that kind of talk, and what a lot of trash it all was. Pious Helen thought it was a shame, but it was the Rams' will, and we had no business questioning their wisdom. Jane sided with Helen, something I believe she came to regret when she was older. Fiona didn't like to take sides against Ember and Umber, but she thought that if we formally petitioned them, as a group, they might agree to bring Martin back, or at least tell us what his offense had been and give him a chance to atone for it. We had all done a great deal of service for the Rams, fought on their behalf, risked our lives for them. They owed us that much. To Martin, we made a great show of sympathetic concern, and we were sympathetic, and we were concerned. But some of the concern was for ourselves, too. Martin was getting older. He was on the cusp of puberty, which was something we knew very little about, but we knew that adulthood followed hard on its heels, and we had never heard of any adults making the journey from our world to Fillory. We understood instinctively that Fillory was a world that ran on innocence, demanded it as an engine demands fuel, and Martin was running out. Sooner or later, we would all run out. Adulthood would come for Helen next, and then me. Like all children, we were selfish little creatures. I hope that this will in some way explain, if not excuse, what we did next. Martin did what he did, but we helped him. We wanted him to do it because we were afraid. We made a pact. The next time any of us were summoned, we would do what we could to hold the doorway open, and we would try to get Martin through. We would jam the door, take control of the bridge that connected Earth and Fillory, and force Martin across it. Probably it wouldn't work, but who could say till we tried? It was counter to the spirit of the enchantment, but you could never tell with enchantments. Sometimes the spirit was what mattered, but sometimes they were just letters on a page, words in the air, and it was only a question, as Humpty Dumpty said, of which is to be master. Chapter 18. This is a story we never told to Christopher Plover. Some days you could feel a portal coming on. To everyone else the day might be sunny and clear, but to us five the air would feel clammy and charged the way it does before a storm. You could sense the world building up to something, screwing itself to the sticking point. Then we would look at each other conspiratorially and pull our ears. That was the agreed-upon sign. And from that point on, we'd be no good for anything else. The madness was on us, and we would fidget feverishly, unable to sit still or read or follow our lessons. Nothing else mattered until someone vanished and the tension finally broke. On other days, Fillory would wrong foot everyone. You wouldn't see it coming at all. You might not even be in the mood for it, but suddenly there it would be, and all you could do was give in to its spell as it tore you free of this world. It was one of those days, the second kind, when it happened. A lazy Saturday when the summer sun seemed to be leeching all the energy from the world, leaving us listless and immobile. We couldn't play, we couldn't study, we couldn't stop yawning. Even the effort of going outside to visit the giant bug-eyed goldfish in the stone-rimmed pond in back of the house would have been unimaginable. Fiona and I were in the library, which was a pleasant room, 2 stories high, with 2 movable ladders which, when rolled into each other at a high rate of speed, produced a very satisfying bang. But as a library, it was largely useless. The books were locked away in cabinets. You could see their spines through metal grills like a forbidden city hidden in the jungle, but you couldn't get at them. As far as I knew, no one could. The keys were lost. There was exactly 1 book in the library that you could read. Somehow it had escaped being incarcerated with the rest of them. It was a catalogue of seashells, a huge volume I could barely lift, and its spine cracked like a pistol shot when you opened it. The photographs were black and white, but about 1 in 50 pages had been hand-tinted in full color, and those shells had a special vivid feel to them, a Fillorian feel. That morning, Fiona and I were leafing through it. The pages were thick and sticky in the heat. They were made of a special glossy paper that was almost rubbery, like the leaves of some huge tropical plant. As usual, we debated the aesthetic merits of the various shells and the possible poisonous properties of their various residents until suddenly Fiona stopped. She'd slipped her hand under the next page, hoping it would be a colored one, but her fingers found only empty air. It was as though the book had suddenly become hollow. She looked at me and pulled her ear. The page turned all by itself, flipped over by a gust of wind from beneath it. From Fillory. The portal was set directly into the book's enormous page. Appropriately enough, it opened onto the seaside. I recognized it right away as the coast north of Whitespire, where there was a long, graceful bridge of living rock that led to a nearby island. We were looking straight down onto the powdery white sand from above, and the urge to clamber through immediately was almost overpowering. As I watched, Fiona actually did, forgetting Martin, forgetting our pact. She stepped up onto her chair and onto the table and dropped through the page as neatly as if she were jumping off a high bank into a pond. I didn't. With a titanic effort, I pulled myself away, feeling like I was leaving skin behind, and ran to find my brother. He was by himself in an empty spare room. He was supposed to be working on a sketch of a vase for a drawing class, but when I came in, he was just watching listlessly as the wind pushed a blind in and then sucked it out again. He stood up as soon as I entered. No words were necessary. He knew why I'd come. I was sure the portal would be closed, but when we came pelting into the library together, it was still there, waiting for us, or at any rate waiting for me. From a distance, the view of the beach through the open book was a perspectival impossibility, a trompe-l'œil. It did strange things to my depth perception. When Martin approached it, the book shifted on the table and tried to shut itself. It seemed affronted, as if we'd surprised it in a state of undress. But Martin was ready for that. He pointed at it with 3 fingers and shouted a phrase I didn't understand. It might have been dwarfish. It had those scraping fricatives dwarfs use. Until then, I hadn't understood that he'd been studying magic. Perhaps he hadn't just been sulking there in the library at Whitespire after all. The book trembled, straining now to shut itself. Martin and the book, Martin and Fillory itself, were fighting, and it was an awful sight, because I loved them both. Martin gripped it in both hands and pulled, grunting, trying to rip it in half. I suppose he thought that then it couldn't close at all. But it was too thick, and the binding was too strong. So instead he forced its jaws back open like a man wrestling an alligator and pinned it down. He climbed up on the table, and slowly, awkwardly, he got his feet and then his legs and hips through the door in the page. As he did it, the book began to groan horribly, as if the wrongness of it, the violation, hurt it physically. When he was all the way through, I thought it would snap closed, but instead it fell back open again, limp and unhappy at having been force-fed a meal it didn't want. Ashamed, I climbed through quickly and dropped onto the beach. Looking back, I saw Jane appear in the doorway of the library, and our eyes met across the gap between worlds, but it was too late for her. The book had had enough Chatwin's for one day, and it closed over my head. The portal vanished. The tide was out, and the wind was slack. The sea was flat as a made bed. It looked about 11 in the morning. Martin was halfway up the dunes already. He had had plenty of time to think through what he would do in Fillory, if he ever got the chance. He was here on borrowed time, and he wasn't going to waste it. "Hey!" I called after him. "Wait for us!" Fiona was watching him too, but she wasn't following. The joke had gone far enough for her. "He's not going to Whitespire," she said quietly. "He's not?" "Martin!" I shouted. "What are you doing?" "I think you should go with him," Fiona said. "Someone should." Martin had paused at the crest and was considering us. "Well, come on then," he said, "if you're coming." I did. Fiona stayed where she was. Nothing happened the way Plover said it did later. All that business with Sir Hotspots in the flying forest is his invention, pure fiction. In reality, it was just me and Martin. I was the only witness. Martin's gait was a stolid, purposeful tramp, and I had to skip every few strides to keep up with him. "Where are we going?"
"I'm not going back," he said.
"What?"
"I'm not going back to England, Roops. I hate it. I hate England, and everybody there hates me. You know that. And if I go home, I'll never get back here again. We both know it. You saw the book. It almost had my legs off. If the Rams want me out, they'll have to throw me out, and when they try, by God, they'll have a fight on their hands."
There was no point in arguing with him. There was a bit of our father in Martin, and just then he sounded like father cursing the Germans, something he used to do often and at great length.
"What are you going to do?"
"Anything," he said. "Everything. Whatever I have to."
"But what?"
"There's something I want to try. I had an idea about a trade."
"A trade? With who? What have you got to trade?"
"I've got me," he snarled. "For what that's worth."
And then less angrily, in the voice of Martin the little boy, who would exist for only an hour or so longer,
"Will you come with me?"
"All right. Where are we going?"
"We're going to see someone. Who knows? Might be you could do a trade with him, too."
He looked over his shoulder to make sure Fiona hadn't followed us. Then he quickly sketched a square in the air with his fingers. The shape became a window looking out over a marshy landscape, and he stepped over the sill and through it. The casual speed with which he did this shocked me deeply. We'd seen magic practiced by Fillorian sorcerers, but none of us had studied it, or not as far as I knew. Martin must have been practicing secretly for months, leading an entire life that he concealed from us. A secret life within a secret life. I followed him through.
"Where are we?"
"Northern Marsh," he said. "Come on."
The ground here was boggy, but Martin picked his way through it with confidence, ever the intrepid explorer. I tried to step where he stepped, but I lost my balance and put a hand down, and it came up covered with black muck. Soon our shoes were full of water, and the marsh was sucking at them as if it liked the taste. I wasn't dressed for this. I was lucky I'd had shoes on at all. After a quarter hour of this, I climbed up on a round rock, an oasis of solidity, and stopped. Ahead was just black puddles and reeds and more black puddles, and then open water.
"Mart, stop!"
He turned and waved at me. Then he took a last look around at the horizon, pressed his hands together in front of him, prayerfully, and dived headfirst down into a puddle. The water barely looked deep enough to reach his ankles, but it swallowed him as completely and easily as if it were an ocean. I watched the surface settle and reseal itself behind him and turn glassy again. Only then did I become truly afraid.
Mart! Martin!
I left my shoes on the rock. For all I know, they're still there, and thrashed ahead to where he'd disappeared and shoved my arm into the puddle up to the shoulder. It had no bottom. I took a deep breath and put my head under. My inner ear spun. I tried to steady myself and instead fell forward. There was a moment of nausea and weightless confusion. Then I was lying on my back on wet ground, gasping like a fish. Gradually everything began to right itself. I was lying on the underside of the swamp, the reverse side of the muddy plain I'd just been tramping through. Gravity had turned upside down. If I looked down, I was looking up through the puddles at the blue sky of Fillory. If I looked up, there was only darkness overhead. It was nighttime in the world under the northern marsh, and before me, across a flat plain of black mud and sun-filled puddles, was a fairy castle made of black stone. Its towers pointed down instead of up, but so did everything, including me. This was new. Martin had taken us somewhere truly strange. Fillory was a land of wonders, but this place had an uncanny quality that I can only describe as not correct. It was a place that shouldn't have been, somewhere off the edge of the board, where you weren't meant to put a playing piece down. This wasn't an ordinary adventure, another legend in the making. I knew already that Plover would never hear about it. This was happening off the books. I could have turned back, but I knew that if I did, I would never have a brother again. I also knew that what was happening to him would happen to me, too. I would have 2 more years, 3 at the most. I didn't want the game to be over yet. I'll follow behind Martin at a safe distance, I thought, and watch what he does. Maybe he's found a way out of the maze. I stood up, fighting vertigo. Martin was waiting for me in front of the great door to the castle. He was sopping wet and smiling, though a little sadly, I thought. I picked my way toward him, avoiding the puddles. "This is it," he said. "Just like they said in the books, but it's different when you really see it."
"Like who said? Martin, what is this?"
"What does it look like?" he said grandly. "Welcome to Castle Blackspire."
"Blackspire?"
Of course it was. It was just the same as Whitespire, stone for stone, but the stones were black, and the windows were empty and dark. It was Whitespire upside down and backward, and in the middle of the night, the way it must look when we were all asleep and dreaming. Martin pulled his sopping sweater off over his head and dropped it with a smack on the smooth stone.
"But who lives here?"
"I'm not sure. At first I thought it might be backward versions of us, you know, Nitram, Trepur, that sort of thing. What's Fiona backward? I can't do it in my head. And we'd have to fight our opposite numbers to the death. But I'm starting to think it's not like that at all."
"Well, and thank God for that. What is it like?"
"I don't know," he said. "Let's find out." He heaved on one of the big doors, and it opened silently on oiled hinges. The great hall inside was lit by torchlight. Pale, silent footmen in black livery stood against the walls.
"Right."
Martin seemed not at all disconcerted. I think he was past fear by then. He raised his voice. He was full of a kind of hopeless bravado.
"Is your master at home?"
The footmen inclined their heads, silent as chess pieces.
"Good. Tell him the High King has arrived, and his brother. We'll wait for him in his throne room. And light some damn fires, it's cold in here."
Two of them withdrew backward, showing proper deference. Or maybe everybody walked backward at Castle Blackspire. We were far off the track here, off the script and improvising. Everything we'd done till now in Fillory was like a game, dress-up, good fun, and then laughing all the way back to the nursery. But Martin was entering into a darker kind of play. This was a double game. He was trying to save his childhood, to preserve it and trap it in amber, But to do that he was calling on things that partook of the world beyond childhood, whose touch would leave him even less innocent than he already was. What would that make him? Neither a child nor an adult, neither innocent nor wise. Perhaps that is what a monster is. I didn't want to follow him. I wanted to stay behind and be a child for a little while longer, but I couldn't stand to lose him either. He led me deeper into the castle. We both knew the way. I dragged my feet, but he strode along like he was on his way to his own birthday party. He was going to make an end of it, one way or another, and he couldn't wait. He was so relieved he was practically glowing.
"I don't like this, Mart. I want to go back."
"Go then," he said. "But there's no going back for me. This is my last stand. I'm breaking the rules, Roop. Either I'll break them or they'll break me. I don't care any more, not since Ember and Umber decided to punish me for nothing at all."
"What rules?"
I was on the point of tears.
"I don't understand."
He steered us into a dressing room off to one side of the throne room, a chamber where up in Castle Whitespire, up in the world of light and air, foreign dignitaries visiting Fillory would await our pleasure. There was a fire here, and I was grateful for the warmth. There were dry clothes, too, in black spire colours, and Martin began stripping off. I kept my wet clothes on.
"I'll tell you how I came to it," he said. "I was thinking, isn't it funny that we get to be kings and queens here? We're children. We're not even from here. There's nothing special about us, not that I can see. But we must have something special, mustn't we? Something you can't get in Fillory."
"I suppose." Fully naked, unembarrassed, he warmed his bare, pale skin in front of the fire. He was happier than I'd seen him in months.
"What is it? I'm damned if I know. My humanity, I suppose. But whatever it is, it means nothing to me, so I'm going to see how much it's worth to them. I've put it up for sale on the open market, and now I've found a taker. We're here to see how much I can get for it."
"I don't understand. You're going to buy your way back into Fillory?"
"Oh, I'm not doing it like that. I'm not asking for favors. What I want is power, enough power that even Ember and Umber won't be able to send me home."
"But Ember and Umber are gods."
"Then maybe I'll be a bit of a god, too."
"But what if—"
I swallowed, simple child that I was.
"If you sell part of yourself, what if you aren't Martin anymore?"
"What if I'm not?" he said. "What good is Martin? Everybody hates him, me included. I'd rather be somebody else, anybody else, even if it's nobody."
He picked up a dry shirt from a neat stack of clothes on a chair.
"I suppose I'm like one of those guests at Maud's parties, the ones who won't go home when it's over, not even after she turns the lights on. But I've got no other home to go to, not any more. When I look at England now, I see a dead place, Rupert, a wasteland. I won't live in a wasteland. I'd rather die in paradise."
The clothes looked rich, and they fit him perfectly, as I knew they would. Cool, shadowy colours, black velvets and small silvery pearls like the little sugar balls they use to decorate cakes. He looked very much like a king.
"Mart, come on," I said,
even though I knew from experience that begging only made him angrier.
"Leave it alone. Let it be how it was."
"Don't."
He jabbed a finger at me. I felt more than 2 years younger than him then. Somewhere he'd learned the secret of a richer, more powerful adult rage.
"It isn't how it was. It never will be again. They changed the rules on us, so as far as I'm concerned, all bets are off."
He cinched his belt tight. "If they apologized, if they showed any regret, then maybe. Maybe. If they would even say why. But they wouldn't, not them. So I'm off to war, like Daddy. They can't give us Fillory and then just take it away again. The rams have sunk low, but I'll sink lower. They're bad, I'll be worse."
He flung open both doors to the throne room. "Mart, who lives here?" I asked. "Whose house is this?"
He went in. I hung back in the doorway.
The walls of the throne room were lined with more footmen, still and heavy-lidded as frogs. The torches burned strangely, not warm and yellow, but sparking and spitting like holiday fireworks.
"Here I am!" Martin shouted.
I couldn't see his face, but I could hear the joy in his voice. He was relishing the rage and shame. I think he'd been keeping them down for a long time, trying to feel nothing at all, and after so much numbness, anything felt sweet, even pain.
"Well, come on!"
He spread his arms wide.
"I've got what you want. Come on and take it."
I think I knew then why they did it, why Ember and Umber wouldn't let us stay in Fillory. It wasn't that we were too old or too sinful. It wasn't so that we could spread their wisdom in another world, our world. It wasn't that being in Fillory made you happy, and in its way too much happiness was as dangerous as too much sadness. That is a lie that even Ember and Umber never told. No, it was that Fillory was cruel, as cruel in its way as the real world was. There was no difference, though we all pretended there was. There was nothing fair about Fillory, just as there was nothing fair about people's fathers going to war and their mothers going mad, and the way we among all animals were cursed with a longing for somewhere better, somewhere that never existed and never would. Fillory was no better than our world. It was just prettier. I didn't think those things, not then, but I felt them all when I looked past Martin into the golden barbell eyes of the great ram Umber, the shadow ram. Castle Blackspire was his house. Umber was Martin's buyer. Give him credit, Martin took this in stride.
"Oh, it's you, is it?" he said. "Well, come on, you old faker. It's all here, and only slightly soiled. Are you ready?"
"Yes," came the resonant reply, not like Ember's voice, higher and calm and civilized, even urbane. "I am ready."
"So go ahead, take it. Take it all, you bloody coward, and give me what I want."
I gave up then. I could have tried one last time to change Martin's mind. I could have tried to drag him out of that room. I could have tried to take his place or to fight a god, but I didn't. I was afraid, and I fled. I ran through the empty halls of the Night Palace and didn't stop till I was lying on my face in the cold mud on the edge of the northern marsh. I never saw my brother again. Martin's disappearance made headlines all over England, pushing even news of the war below the fold. The English love a good tragedy, especially when it involves a child, and this one was a 9 days' wonder. Detectives were dispatched to Fowey from Penzance and London and farther away. Dockery House was turned upside down from attic to basement, and Plover's house was too. Notices were circulated, dogs were loosed, gardens were dug up, ponds and fountains were dragged, men with slight builds were lowered into abandoned wells. An amazing number of lost things were recovered. Bicycles, pets, keys, odd items of silver, one or two petty criminals, in one case a rogue bassoon which had been stolen and then apparently abandoned in a ha-ha when it proved impossible to sell. The bassoonist having by that time pined for it and then passed away, the instrument was lodged temporarily and then eventually permanently by the police at Dockery House, as if by way of an apology, a sort of replacement for the child they never managed to find. Jane, in her inscrutable way, learned to play it passably well. A cloud of suspicion settled on Christopher Plover, but over time it dispersed, as clouds will, pausing on its way to shadow a few of the less savory locals in turn, but always inconclusively. Truth to tell, Plover was a little heartbroken when Martin disappeared. There was no evidence, and no arrests were ever made. We children knew where Martin had gone, of course, more or less, though I never told the others everything I knew.
I never told them it was Umber who'd taken Martin's offer. I didn't have the heart to do it. I think the adults knew we were keeping something to ourselves, but they could never put their big, clumsy, groping fingers on what it was. It was our shared secret. But we didn't all feel the same way about what he'd done. Helen, in particular, always the arch Ramsian, was scathing about it, excoriating Martin for defying Ember and Umber's will, as she saw it. But I believe that we all understood it, and even, on some level, admired it. I know that I did. It must have taken great will and resourcefulness to seek out Umber, to strike the deal, and then to go through with it. He was many things, and God only knows what he is now. But Martin was not stupid, and he wasn't a coward. Though it was difficult to reconcile Martin's escape into Fillory with the damage it caused in the real world, one of the secrets Martin must have learned down below the northern marsh was how not to care about some things, and there was power in that, the power to live as though his actions had no consequences. It fell to us to witness the consequences, and they were ugly. Our mother's nerves were always fragile, and Martin's disappearance finally and permanently annihilated her. We saw her more and more rarely, and when we did, in one or other dispiriting institutional setting, she never failed to accuse us of keeping Martin from her. Her own children seemed sinister and alien to her. She knew, somehow, that we knew. And she was right. But I never saw Martin again. I always looked for him, though as time passed I became more and more worried about what would happen if I found him. He could or would not show himself to me. I've never understood why not. He certainly had the chance. There were more adventures left for us in Fillory, most of which ended up in A Secret Sea and The Wandering Dune. I didn't turn them down. Even after what I'd seen that day, even with my heart half broken, I still could never say no to Fillory. And then Fillory said no to us. By the end of A Secret Sea, I was 12, and after that I was never asked back. One by one we became too old. Helen had one final adventure, in the company of Jane, and the two girls returned bearing a box of magical buttons, which Jane claimed could have given them free entry to Fillory forever. But Helen considered the buttons to be a perversion of magic. She thought using them would be a blasphemy against the Rams, and she disposed of them immediately and could not be persuaded to divulge their hiding place. Her arguments were very Ramsian indeed, and everyone sided against her, even Jane. It was a schism, and after it, we Chatwin children were never as close again, and our integrity as a tribe was diminished even further. Maybe the strangest consequence of Martin's disappearance was that Plover started writing. Whatever went on between him and Martin, when that ended, the writing began. And one day Plover surprised us with a book. He'd had it privately printed. He called it The World in the Walls. The cover was his own charmingly amateurish drawing of Martin and the grandfather clock. It will sound strange, but after the initial surprise, the book never interested us much. We took one cursory glance at it, made fun of the illustrations. Plover had the most ignorant, sentimental ideas of what a dwarf looked like. But we already knew everything in it. People like to call the Fillory books magical, but they never seemed that way to us. If you've seen magic, then the Fillory books are very pale imitations indeed. Plover's words were like dried flowers, stiff and crumbling, crushed flat between pages, when we'd had the living, blooming blossoms all around us. Now all I can see is how simple he made everything sound. Reading the Fillory books, you would think that all one has to do is behave honorably and bravely, and all will be well. What a lesson to teach young children! What a way to prepare them for the rest of their lives. We each of us on our own found ways to get on without Fillory. The real world was not as fantastical and brightly colored as Fillory, but it was very distracting nonetheless, and if it didn't contain any pegasi or giants, it was absolutely teeming with girls who seemed almost as magical and dangerous. Fillory was sweet, but this world was very savory. It was easy to let Fillory go when every football match and scholarship examination and furtive kiss told you to stop fighting, forget it, let it be, leave it behind. We talked about Fillory less and less among ourselves, and we went to Plover's less and less, and the whole business began to seem less and less real. By this time the books had begun to sell, too, and a miraculous rain of money began to fall upon us. We wouldn't have said it out loud, or even to ourselves, but it was as if we had sold Fillory itself. Or rather, we'd sold its realness, reduced it to the status of a children's fantasy, in exchange for regular and startlingly large payments into accounts which would come under our control when we were 21. By the time I was 17 and sitting an entrance examination for Merton College, Oxford, I'm not entirely sure I believed in Fillory at all anymore. Jane did. She never stopped looking for the buttons that Helen hid, and when she disappeared at 13, I believed that she found them. But she knew better than to try to take me with her, and none of us tried to follow her. When she did not return, I could only assume that she went down the same path that Martin did. It has been years now since Helen or Fiona or I have mentioned Fillory to each other, except as it pertains to our finances. We don't talk about Martin or Jane. In their way, they've come to seem as fantastical to us as the Cozy Horse. Without those things, we've got very little to talk about at all, and I would pay any price not to have to suffer any more of Helen's glittery-eyed, American-accented chatter about Jesus. It's as though we three are the survivors of a great disaster, like the bombing of a city, the way London is being bombed to pieces now. And to even mention what happened would be to risk calling back the planes to blast us to pieces all over again. I wouldn't even have written this much had it not been for the events that have overtaken Britain and the world in the past 3 years. They have driven me to extremes of desperation I would never have thought possible. There is no telling now who will triumph in the present conflict, and there is every chance that the Germans will overrun England itself before it is all over. Perhaps help will come. Perhaps Martin is able to perceive events in this world from wherever he is, and he will come back. If he doesn't care to, I would think that at least Jane would. If they are unable to intervene in the affairs of this world, perhaps Ember or Umber could. That would be a welcome sight. My long-lost brother and sister and the two great rams of Fillory, aflame with power, marching abreast on Berlin, to chivy Hitler out of his bunker like a stoat. But they haven't come, and I am beginning to think that they are not going to come. And that is why I am writing these words. This book is a memoir, a secret history, but it is also an act of calculated provocation. I am at present with the 7th Armored Division in Tobruk, in Libya, preparing for a battle tomorrow with Rommel and his panzers. I, Rupert Chatwin, a king of Fillory, who rode a griffin against the armies of the Whispering King, who beat the White of the West in single combat and broke his back, will fight the Germans in an obsolete Crusader tank full of lice and the stink of me and my comrades-in-arms that has already leaked oil across half of northern Africa. If I survive, I will send this home with instructions that it be published 6 months from now, unless word arrives from me. The news that Fillory is real will be splashed across every paper in Britain, unless you agree to take me and my family back. Yes, I address you directly, Ember and Umber, Martin and Jane. If not me, then save my wife and my child, your only nephew. That is all I ask. Surely it is within your power. Surely you can find it in your hearts. But if that is still not enough, then I offer you goods in trade. I was not completely honest before. When I left Castle Blackspire that day, I did not leave empty-handed.
Blackspire is Whitespire's twin, and I knew where the treasure room was, and I knew how to open it. Even in my fear and grief, I was still selfish enough and spiteful enough to plunder it for whatever I could carry. I wasn't an adept like Martin, but even I could recognize power when I saw it. I took a blade and a spell, and I believe they are very powerful indeed. They are of the old workings, the very strongest stuff. You can come and try to take them from me, but I think you will not. Here, I offer them to you freely, if you will do this thing. For the love of God, Ember and Umber, Martin and Jane, or for the love of whatever it is that you hold sacred, if you are reading these words, take us back to Fillory. For all the ways I have betrayed you, I beg your forgiveness. I will atone for my sins any way you like, if you will open the door again one last time for me and my family. I was once a king of Fillory, but I will return as your lowliest servant if you will only open the door. I am begging you now. When I turn this page, I want you to open the door. The book ended there. Plum let it lie open on her lap. It felt like it weighed approximately 1,000 pounds. She couldn't look at Quentin. She didn't want to share this moment with him. Maybe she would in a moment, but not yet. They hadn't come. They hadn't saved him. And Rupert's stolen goods had stayed stolen, and he'd died there in the desert. Though his wife and child, Plum's grandfather, had survived anyway. The blade, that was what Betsy took. At first, Plum wondered about the spell, but it was there too, cut up and bound into the notebook at the end on lumpy parchment slightly smaller than the pages around it, a dozen leaves of close writing in a foreign script. Then it all went blurry, because Plum's eyes were full of tears. She had denied it all her life, that any of it was real, but not any more. Not after this, and not after what the girl in the mirror had shown her. It had really happened. It wasn't just a story, it was a true story. It had found her, drawn her into its pages, and now it was time for her to play her part in it. Fillory had chewed up her ancestors and spat them out. Now it was hungry again and coming for her, and she would have to find a way to face it. She put her head in her hands and leaked some more tears there in the lobby of the Amenia train station. After 5 minutes, she got up and went to the snack bar for some napkins to blow her nose on. "Quentin," she said when she got back, "I think Fillory was real." It was hard to force the words out. They didn't want to be said. "I know it sounds crazy, but I think he was telling the truth. I think it was all real." Quentin only nodded. He didn't look surprised. If anything, she suspected him of having dabbed away a tear or two when she wasn't looking. "It is real, Plum," he said. "I've been there." Chapter 19. The townhouse stood on a back street in the West Village, one of the oddly angled ones where the orderly grid of Manhattan starts to break down into chaos below 14th Street. It didn't get much traffic, which was part of the point. It was a discreet address. Plum said she'd bought it with money from her grandparents, her share of the Fillory royalties that they'd put in trust, intending to use it as a crash pad during her glorious post-graduation future in New York. Now she and Quentin were crashing there a little early. From the outside it looked dark and deserted, and they were careful to maintain that appearance. A lot of people wanted that suitcase, and Quentin didn't know who they would come after first, him and Plum or Asmodeus, but they would be coming sooner or later,
and probably they would hit the softer target first, and that was not Asmodeus. For now, they would lose themselves in the big city. Nobody had touched the house since the previous owner moved out. There wasn't even any furniture, so they sat on the dusty wooden floor in the front room. They were running on empty, worn out from the disaster of the robbery, and then worn out all over again in a different way by reading Rupert's journal. But Quentin forced himself to set up a thin perimeter of magical defense before they slept. Nothing fancy, standard magical tradecraft, and the bare minimum of it, but it was enough to take the house off the grid and make it opaque to anybody who was poking around, though not so opaque as to be suspicious. He didn't bother with the upper floors. They'd just stay out of them for now. Then they collapsed on the floor of the living room, still in their coats and hats. They'd have to get some couches in here, or at least some sleeping bags, and some food, and some heat, but not yet. Quentin hadn't slept the night before, and he'd thrown his back out in the fall, and he was starting to be in some serious pain. It had happened to him a couple of times before. Up through around 25, he'd never even thought about his back. It was a balanced, frictionless, self-regulating system. Now it felt like a busted gearbox into which somebody had chucked a handful of sand. Lying on the hard floor made it hurt less. Quentin thought about how wrong things had gone. Things so often went wrong. Was it him? Was he making the same mistake over and over again? Or different mistakes? He'd like to think he was at least making different mistakes. Plum did fall asleep, right there on the floor, with her face smushed into her black parka from the limo for a pillow. But Quentin didn't. Not yet. The journal had affected them in different ways. For Plum, it had been a reckoning, a massive correction, that finally forced her to see that Fillory was real, and that in some inescapable way she was part of it. On the train, he'd told her the whole story of his life there, from beginning to end, as bridges and stations and other trains flashed by in the window, and lots full of idle municipal snowplows and backyards full of overturned play structures. He told her about everything, Alice and Julia and all the rest. But for him it was different, and while Plum slept, he sat up, leaning against the wall, and read the journal again. There was news in it. If Rupert was to be believed, then Umber was the one who'd turned Martin into the beast in exchange for some obscure, grotesque sacrifice. That threw Quentin as much as anything else. There was something seriously wrong with one of Fillory's gods, or at least there had been. And if Umber did help Martin, why would Martin have killed him, as Jane Chatwin said he did? It made no sense. None of it got him any closer to Alice, either, or not that he could see. They needed a new plan, a way forward, maybe even another job. They'd be ready next time. The bird had betrayed them. It hadn't played by the rules. But now Quentin got that there never had been any rules. But first they had to rest and build themselves back up. Quentin had to get his back working again. He also had some hard thinking to do. Plum woke up at dawn, bursting with energy again. She was indefatigable that way. She always had to be doing something. Going outside seemed like a bad idea, with the whereabouts and intentions of the bird still unknown, so they stayed in. They ordered in a lot of takeout food and some cheap insta-furniture, and Plum set about fixing up her house. Somebody had discoized it in the 1970s, and then later it had been de-discoized, mostly, but there were still trace amounts of avocado carpeting and the outlines of mirrored tiles that had been glued to the walls. A space-age chandelier that looked like Sputnik had escaped the purge, too. But the house had good bones, and it still had its broad-planked wooden floors and its elegant, many-paned, energy-inefficient wooden-framed windows with nice old shutters. There were a lot of nice, twiddly plaster ornaments around the ceiling. It had some integrity, this house. Plum knew more about this kind of magic than Quentin did, and Quentin was hobbled by his bad back, so he acted as semi-skilled magical laborer consultant to her hyper-competent general contractor. Under her direction, they arrested the slow collapse of the back wall, which was being undermined by rainwater because the drain pipe was busted and the drain in the back patio was clogged. No one had updated the electrics and plumbing since approximately the 1930s, and the walls were stuffed full of ancient cloth-wrapped wiring and lead pipes that were right on the point of dissolving. They shored everything up as best they could. It felt good to be doing something simple and concrete and achievable. They cast all the cleaning spells they could think of until they'd removed enough dust and dirt and scum and nicotine residue from the walls and floors and sinks and tubs to make a whole other house out of. They got the furnace going and the gas and water. But while Quentin was working with his hands, his mind was working on other things. All his enterprises were in ruins. He should have been thrashed by this, flattened, but instead, with all of that gone, and his father dead, and Mayakovsky's coins in his pocket, he felt strangely free. It was time to take stock. At some point, somebody had gone through the top floor of the house and demolished all its interior walls, leaving behind only four lonely load-bearing columns of brick, with bits of plaster still clinging to them, thus making a single long chamber front to back. Plum continued to roam the house wearing overalls and work gloves, attacking and repairing targets of opportunity. She didn't want his help, and moreover his back was still killing him. So he went up there to clear his mind. Using a chunk of kids' street chalk recovered from a locker under the stairs, Quentin traced out a classical labyrinth pattern on the floor. He did it from memory, based on the ancient Greek Lemnian pattern, and it took him quite a few tries to make the geometry of it work out, but that itself was a solid meditative exercise. The path wound and coiled around the four pillars. Labyrinths were old sorcery and subtle, good for recharging one's magical resources when they were running low. When it was done, he hung sheets over the windows, which looked cheap and tatty, but produced a dim, diffuse, immaterial light. He started at the beginning and slowly limped through it, again and again. The walking freed his thoughts. It also made his back feel a bit better. His mind wandered back to Rupert's journal, and on the spell bound into the back of it. Rupert had never cast it, as far as Quentin could tell, nor had he been able to figure out what it did. Now Quentin wondered. It was a treasure pillaged from the black underbelly of Fillory. It had to be something valuable. And there was something fateful in the way it had come to them. What had Rupert called it? One of the old workings? Maybe it was war magic, something that could help them if the bird came after them. Maybe it was something deep and strange and strong enough that it could help Alice. He went and got the spell and read through it as he walked. Before long, he could walk the maze without even looking up from it. His work on the page from the Netherlands wasn't going to go to waste, that was for sure, at least in terms of having sharpened his ability to construe gnarly magical rhetoric in languages that he had a very dim grasp of. It had been a long time since he tried to read archaic Fillorian, let alone its associated notations for magical gestures. The further into it he got, the less it looked like what he'd expected. He was anticipating something military, either a very powerful shield or a very deadly weapon, or both. Maybe concealment, maybe some kind of cataclysmic weather effect. But it didn't feel like any of those. It wasn't shaped right, somehow. For one thing, the spell was long as hell. You could transcribe most spells in a couple of pages, max, because there just wasn't that much to them, but this one went on and on for a good 20. There was a lot of formal business toward the front end of the casting that looked purely ceremonial, but you never knew for sure what you could leave out, so you had to do it all. What's more, it required a lot of materials, including some pretty exotic items. All in all, it was a bear, and it would have cost somebody a lot of time and effort and money to cast it. It was worse than the bond-breaking spell, which they'd never even got to cast at all, damn it. Still,
There was something elegant about it, too. It was a mess, a rat's nest, but under all the fiddly bits and the ornamentation, there was a structure, a complex one. Later stages of the enchantment looped in elements of earlier ones, piling effect on effect, each one multiplying the next. In its way, it was a thing of real beauty. For a while, he wondered